Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a little bit snarky about all things books. This is a brand new podcast, so if you like it, I'd really love your support. Please spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, and rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. This week, I'm so excited to have one of my dream guests joining me, Annie Jones, owner of The Bookshelf, an independent bookstore in Thomasville, Georgia. And oh my gosh, I'm just in my head hearing you say that.
I know. That was so weird. You forgot beautiful downtown Thomasville, Georgia.
She's also the co-host of the From the Front Porch podcast, which is where she says that little phrase over and over again. And it's one of my very favorite book podcasts, and she's joining me today. Annie is quite possibly my number one book recommendation source, and I surveyed you all way back in February, and Annie was the person that you requested you wanted to hear from on my podcast the most. So I'm so happy to have her here. Welcome, Annie.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I'm really so excited and so honored that anybody wants to hear more from me.
Believe it or not, there are many questions that we have for you that we have, I don't think, heard about you talk about a ton. So,
oh, good.
So as you saw, I asked my listeners on Instagram a while back what they wanted to hear you talk about. And the majority of the questions were related to the bookstore. So that's what we're going to focus mostly on today. There'll be some other stuff thrown in. That's where we'll start.
All right.
So I have a business background. So the business side of things always interests me. I love that you have taken a local bookstore and made it nationally and probably internationally known. Was that in your plan from the beginning? How did you come up with that strategy?
That's a great question. I wish that it had been a really formulated strategy, like with a business plan, but I do not have a background in business. I think we might touch on this a little bit later, but I got my degree in liberal arts with an emphasis in journalism. And so when I took over The Bookshelf, it's a bookstore that's been in existence in Thomasville for over 30 years. So this was a risk in that taking over any business is a risk. But also, my husband and I kind of had done the research and we saw that people had loved and supported The Bookshelf for 30 years, so they would keep supporting it. But what we kind of didn't fully realize or understand when we took over was what makes The Bookshelf so special is its location in downtown Thomasville. Downtown Thomasville is not a huge town, but of more concern was that the population had not grown. So when we looked at the research, we were like, okay, well, so if we want to grow The Bookshelf, like if we want The Bookshelf to make more money, bookstores are interesting. The profit margin is not huge, as most people are aware.
Right.
And so besides stocking the store with gifts, which we do try to do, what are some things we can do to grow it? So we realized it would need to be grown outside the Thomasville area. So the previous owner kind of had mentioned briefly, like, hey, it'd be fun if you did a podcast, like introduce yourself to Thomasville. And I've said before on other interviews, that was a great idea. The original mission was never filled. A podcast was not really the right way to introduce me to the Thomasville community. But one thing I think I am good at is that if you tell me something, I will go run with it. So when the previous owner mentioned this podcast, we immediately took off with the idea, but it wound up growing not in Thomasville, like it wasn't a good way to introduce me to people. Instead, it became a great outreach kind of marketing tool. Similarly, when I took over The Bookshelf, there was no Instagram. So that was something I did immediately know that we could do. So Instagram was certainly not as big as it is now. But I thought, well, this is a way to at least connect with our current customers. But down the road, it might even be a way to expand. And part of that came from, I was not by any means like some prolific blogger, but I did have a blog. I mean, I think everybody did 10 years ago.
Right. And some of us are dinosaurs and still have them.
And so through kind of that, I thought, well, maybe between the podcast and Instagram and maybe some of my old blog friends, maybe this is a way, if not to grow The Bookshelf monetarily, at least to grow its reach. So people at least know we exist. So I didn't have like a written down strategy, but one of my goals when I took over really was I thought Thomasville had something special and I wanted other people to know about it. It does come from this idea that, wait, this really cool thing exists. Only Thomasville knows about it. I want to change that. And in the past probably 2 years, the podcast and Instagram have been able to help us monetarily and financially. you know, I hesitate to say it was always part of the plan. Jordan and I really did know if we wanted to do this long term, we did need to grow the business.
Sure.
When your population isn't growing, I think you have to get creative.
And I think you really have, in addition to, you know, making the bookstore nationally known, really put Thomasville on the map too.
I hope so.
I'd never heard of Thomasville before your podcast. And I live in the South.
Okay. I think that was really what was important to me. It's bonkers. But when we get customers who come in and they admit that they're visiting, they're from far away and they're like on their way to somewhere else, or they've made a trip just to Thomasville because of the podcast, that fills me with such joy, because the more tourists can recognize how special Thomasville is, yes, my business grows and that's awesome and wonderful, but also Thomasville grows and my fellow business owners who are just like me trying to run small businesses, their businesses grow. So it's good for the town.
Yes.
That is definitely something I want our continued growth to do.
That's awesome. So as a bookstore owner rather than a bookseller, where do you spend the most of your time?
Oh, what a great question. This has changed a lot over the past 6 years that I have run the store. So probably the first 3 years that I was co-owning it and running it, I did spend a lot of time hand selling and on the floor, partly because Thomasville didn't know who I was yet and I wanted them to trust me.
Sure.
And I prefer spending a lot of time on the floor. I love hand selling books. Gosh, that's still the dream. That's still what I love to do.
Yes.
But probably over the past 2 years, specifically since I've had a really capable, competent staff, since I've been able to add managers who I really trust and booksellers who I really trust, I probably spend half of my time working upstairs. So I spend about half my time upstairs paying bills, doing payroll, taking care of just an exorbitant amount of taxes, and doing kind of the boring stuff, I think, that nobody wants to do. But in that umbrella of boring stuff is also responding to emails, interacting with customers long distance through email, recording podcast episodes with Chris. This is so weird, but like growing my own kind of Instagram account and remembering to post book reviews and things like that.
Yes.
So I would say it is about 50-50 right now, maybe 60-40, where 40 to 50% of my time is spent still on the floor, putting together shelf subscriptions with Olivia, and then interacting with my local customers who I love, planning events. I will say I do love that, but I have learned if I want to own the bookshelf long-term, which I do, then I have to learn what I can and can't do long term. So right now, there's no one else to pay the bills and do the boring stuff. And maybe down the road, financially, I'll be able to hire a bookkeeper or a more regular accountant. But until that time comes, I've got to do that. Nobody else can do those things. So the things I can delegate, I'm trying to be better about delegating.
So this kind of gets into my next question. You already said one thing, and that may be your number one, but what is the best piece of advice you would have for small business owners? This came from a listener, by the way.
Okay. Well, I wonder if this listener is a small business owner. My best piece of advice would be to ask for help and understand that other people are asking for help too. They just might not be talking about it. So this is a recent lesson I learned. I had the awesome privilege and experience of getting to go to London as part of this very London tour.
Y'all, if you're not a Patreon subscriber for From the Front Porch, Annie does a whole episode on her London trip where she talks a lot about this. If you're interested in subscribing, I thought that was a wonderful episode.
Oh, thank you. That was like when it was fresh on my brain. I have so much to unpack from that week I spent there. But one of my biggest takeaways had to do with being around other small business owners and other creative entrepreneurs. And I was so struck by how immediately, like, we were kind of sitting around talking. And one of the first questions someone asked me was, so who's your business coach? Like, you can have one of those. And then somebody else asked about personal assistant.
Oh, wow. What's that?
Yes. I was immediately like, wait a minute. And I realized all these women who I respect and admire, I respect and admire them because they're doing what they do well. They're doing what they do well because they're delegating the other things.
Sure.
Sometimes that isn't financially feasible, but sometimes it is, and we don't even know it's an option.
Right.
I think you or I might have this gut impulse of personal assistant. Who can afford a personal assistant? But I think more than we realize, small business owners have help, but I don't know if we're publicly talking about it. And so
Sure. Don't
be afraid to delegate and ask for help. Otherwise, I think you're going to drown. There have been times when I have felt like all I'm doing is treading water.
Absolutely. I love that. And in life too, I think that applies to everything. So what is something that would surprise people about owning a bookstore?
All these questions, I'm like, oh God, what to say? Okay. It is as magical as You've Got Mail makes it seem. And that magic doesn't go away. Like, I still get really excited when a box of books comes in. And that's ludicrous because we get a box of books like every day.
Yes.
But I'm still genuinely excited. But it is, I don't know if this would be surprising. I think some people probably are, you know, this. It is financially taxing to own a small bookstore, especially.
Right.
The profit margin is not large. So you really do have to think outside the box through podcasting, through gift product, through Instagram, through deals on Amazon Prime Day. So, you know, I don't have a business degree. Jordan does. And so we kind of muddle through together and we're in the process of asking for help and getting guidance in various ways. But I guess any of, I don't know, would not have realized the many, many, many logistics that go into every little part of running a store. And I think that would be a surprise to people because hopefully what we're doing is making it seem like magic and making it easy because we want our customers to have a really awesome, pleasant experience. We don't want it to look like we're stressing. I mean, that's my big thing is, you know, if we're stressed, then the customer is stressed and that's unpleasant for everyone.
You want to be a duck, like churning underwater, but you're just smoothly gliding on top of the water.
Yes. And that can be a struggle for me, right? Because I really want to be authentic and I really want people to know, hey, I'm working really hard. I don't want to lie about like the difficulties of it. But it would have been surprising to me to know how hard owning a business is because of the many, many logistics. So I think that would be what is most surprising.
Yeah, I can see that completely. All right. So switching gears a little bit to talk about the books in the bookstore.
Okay.
How do you possibly decide what to buy for the bookstore? What is your sort of the bookshelf's, I guess, bookstore personality, if you will?
Yeah. I love this because you as a book podcaster and a bookstagrammer know how many books there are in the world.
Oh, yes.
So I think when you travel to different independent bookstores, they all have probably the personality of the bookstore owner. If the owner is super involved, maybe it's the bookstore buyer. For us, it's probably, I am the primary bookstore buyer, a book buyer. Olivia and Lucy certainly help, but I am the primary book buyer. So the bookshelf certainly reflects my own personal literary tastes. So what you see on the floor is books I love and have handpicked based on publisher recommendations, based on what Olivia and Lucy and Nancy read, and then what I love. So the bookstore personality is a big old chunk of Annie.
Sure.
Also very reflective of Thomasville.
Do those align? Do Annie and Thomasville reading taste align?
They align more now than they used to.
Where's the Venn diagram there?
The Venn diagram is literary fiction.
Okay.
The Venn diagram overlaps at dysfunctional family lit because there is some literary fiction, and we'll talk about this I think later, but like Fire Sermon comes to mind as a book that maybe was it for Thomasville, but it was very, very much for me.
Right.
But I sold a lot of that book and then had really great conversations about it because not all of my customers liked it like I did. And that's okay. Like, that's the point. I want to interact with customers and I want to know, why'd you love this? Why didn't you love this? Thomasville skews older. So like there's a large retirement community here. So they read commercial fiction, which I do not always read. They read a lot of John Grisham.
Uh-huh.
They read a lot of James Patterson. And I'm not going to shame them for that. Like, I just want people reading.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it helps me be more well-rounded. I don't want the bookshelf to just reflect my tastes because if the world was made up of just me's, that would be awful and boring. And I don't want that. I want a community that reads diversely, which is why I'm very grateful that Olivia reads a lot of, so she reads a lot of really well-written thrillers and suspense novels. So by bringing on people like Olivia and Lucy and Chris, their tastes are reflected in the store as well. So what you see on the floor, like if you were to come to the bookshelf tomorrow, what you see on the floor is all handpicked. We have picked every book that is in the store.
Right.
Any independent bookstore, I think, reflects the owner and the community in which it's set. Another thing you would look in and see is a pretty vibrant regional section because Southern storytelling is real and the power of it is true. We have a really great history and politics section because we have a lot of readers who love history. This is my favorite thing. So a couple years ago, we had some political books on display and we have a big wall of New York Times bestsellers. So sometimes our store reflects what's on the New York Times list.
Sure.
But I had a customer come in and pull me aside and inform me that, you know, where were all the conservative books? Why did I only have liberal books on display?
Ooh.
And we were standing right by a display and I turned around and I was like, I mean, that's what these are. And she was kind of taken aback and like she hadn't looked. I want to reflect a diverse range of literature so sure. People can come in and make up their minds for themselves. and read and get a diverse opinion of thoughts. Anyway, so like I was really bothered by it. And I kid you not, probably 5 minutes later, another customer came in and he pulled me aside and he said the exact opposite.
Oh my gosh.
Asking where the other, I can't remember the example I gave, but like he asked the exact opposite. And I thought, oh, well, now I don't have to change a thing.
I was going to say that is confirmation that you're doing it right.
So I thought, okay, because at first I really was like, oh no, like, do I need to rearrange some displays? Because we do have those books. Maybe we just don't have them out. Like, what's going on?
Right.
And I thought, okay, then we're doing okay. Because yeah, in my liberal arts kind of great books education, one of the big things is that books not only speak to the reader, they speak to each other. So we really pride ourselves on our end caps and our displays. We want books to be in conversation with one another. Sometimes that means books that wouldn't necessarily agree with each other or authors that wouldn't necessarily agree with each other are put side by side.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, books talk to each other. So if I had to put the bookstore's personality in a nutshell, the bookshelf is thoughtful and quirky and always asking a lot of questions.
Oh, love that. So this is kind of taking the flip side. Is there a book that you stock solely because it sells like hotcakes, but you just can't believe it sells like hotcakes?
I'm going to spin this slightly. So I read and really liked Where the Crawdads Sing.
Uh-huh.
It, for me, was not a 5-star book. Now, look, pretty much everyone I know disagrees with me about this. So I liked it when it came out. And look, Delia Owens is from Thomasville, born and raised.
Yes.
So that's why I want to be, well, I always want to be kind and thoughtful. But I think what I can't believe, I mean, that book has been on the New York Times bestseller list, I think, for 36 weeks as of this recording, which is unbelievable. Like the last time I remember one being on that long was All the Light We Cannot See.
And it's a debut too.
It's a debut. And All the Light We Cannot See was brilliant.
Right. I mean, it won the Pulitzer.
Yeah. And I want to again state, I liked Where the Crawdads Sing. I think I gave it like 3.5 stars when I read it a year or two ago. My customers, first of all, love that book because of who Delia is. And she is wonderful. Like I have gotten to meet her. She's coming to our store again in September. She's delightful. And so our community naturally wanted to support her. So probably the first 150 copies of that book we sold because of who Delia is.
Sure.
But seeing it stay on the New York Times bestseller list, and as of this recording, I think we are nearing 500 copies sold, which I cannot state how insane that is for a small, I mean, we are a small little bookstore in the middle of nowhere.
Has it outpaced We Were the Lucky Ones for you? I know that was your top selling book last year, maybe?
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason it has outpaced it, so We Were the Lucky Ones was a hand sell forever. Like that was just a book I loved and so sold to everyone I knew. Then it became our one book selection, which meant then it continued to kind of...
Long tail.
Yeah. Where the Crawdads Sing is our one book for this year.
Okay.
And we have sold that many books without it being the one book selection.
Oh, wow. So it's just going to keep continuing to take off.
Yeah. And there is no doubt in my mind, by the way, that I would stock that book. Even though for me it was a 3.5-star, this goes back to like what we stock. That is a book that has romance, mystery, courtroom drama, beautiful nature writing. That's my favorite part.
Yeah.
So Where the Crawdads Sing kind of falls in that category for me, only because I have been blown away by how it continues to sell. Like you could say, oh, well, it's Reese Witherspoon effect, but Daisy Jones and the Six did not sell like that for us. And it sold well, but nothing like Where the Crawdads Sing. It has blown me away. Where the Crawdads Sing is one I can put in and truly just about anybody's hands. And I think that's why it has continued to be popular and sell. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, it has been a little bit mind-blowing to me.
I understand. I did love it. I thought it was 5 stars, but it was funny. As I was reading it, I was like, oh, that's a cliche. I really should dislike that, but I don't. I really want to find out what's going to happen.
Yeah. And I will say 3.5 stars, but that ending, I really liked. I thought the ending was very smart. I really liked it. And, you know, I love that my customers like it. I like that my mom and dad like it. Like nothing brings a bookseller more joy than somebody falling in love with a book. Even if it's a book that we didn't personally love, that doesn't really matter. Like I just want people to love books.
All about reading what you want to read.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Last question about the bookstore itself.
Okay.
And this is more of like a confirmation, something I've been hearing around. And listeners, if you all remember a couple weeks back to the podcast where Grace and Becca from Bad on Paper came on, we talked about a practice in bookstores that we thought might happen and we've heard that goes on, but we're not sure. And it was the practice of co-oping. And it's when publishers pay a premium for their specific books to be featured on the front table at bookstores. So I said back then that I was going to ask an upcoming bookseller guest to tell me a little bit about this. So Annie, can you tell us a little bit about kind of how this works and, you know, how it works specifically at the bookshelf?
Yeah. So I think this is really interesting because co-oping was not something I really knew anything about.
I don't think in general people do.
And I, as a bookseller, probably didn't know about it until 2 years ago because this is something the bookshelf does not do.
Oh, interesting.
Like accidentally, I don't do it. This would be surprising. I think maybe. No, I think everybody who has a job, probably this is true for their job. Bookselling is interesting because it feels pretty insular, meaning when you come in from outside, so like I did not work as a bookseller in high school or anything like that. So it's all brand new to me. I used to work for state government. When you work for state government, they use acronyms and you're like, wait, no one knows what this means.
Yes.
My biggest fear is looking like an idiot. And it's a terrible fear to have. And I'm working on it. So I, you know, would get these publisher offers, like co-op offers, and I would just ignore them because I was like, I don't know what that means. So I'm going to delete that, which is not a good business model, by the way. So I will say that any co-op offers the bookshelf has done, this is more my understanding of it. If we do an event, for example, we have done a lot. You've probably seen it on Instagram. We did for a while there a lot of dot journaling classes.
Yes.
So we do events like that at the bookshelf because we're off the beaten path. Not a ton of authors come our way. So to make up for that, we host a lot of authorless events. So when we do a class like dot journaling or like chess or understanding the U.S. Constitution or whatever it is, we pair it with a book. And so your ticket includes a book. So we take advantage of co-op offers in that way.
Right.
Meaning I chose a dot journaling book and I contacted the publisher and they gave me, I don't even know what it was, like $50 back or $50 credit.
Right.
We don't do that often, if at all, but when we do, it's for events. I don't know a ton of bookstores that are doing that to put books on their like front tables. Sometimes a publisher will contact and say, hey, we're having this offer where if you have a display, like I think recently Gentleman in Moscow came out in paperback. And so a publisher was like, if you do a display and take a picture, we'll give you a co-op offer or we'll give you some credit or you'll be entered to win a prize. I wound up not doing it, but that would have been an easy one to do because I believe in that book anyway.
Sure.
I would never, and I don't know many bookstores who would, because a lot of independent bookstores really pride themselves on their independence.
Right.
So I don't know a ton of bookstores who would be like, yeah, I'll do that book, even though I don't believe in that book, and put it on my front table for $50 credit. Now, I do think as a bookseller, I should probably be doing more to take advantage of co-op offers because financially they're a help.
Right.
There just is not a big profit margin on books. So I think publishers probably, sure, are trying to get their books in bookstores. But I also think we're trying to keep bookstores alive over here. Like we're trying to still have viable businesses.
You should advertise that you don't do this.
I didn't know about it. So I didn't know like regular customers about it.
After the episode aired where we talked about this, I did hear from a listener who works at a small press.
Okay.
And she said Barnes & Noble absolutely does this. And it's hard for the small presses because Barnes & Noble's tables are booked just months and months and months in advance. And the small presses don't know what's coming down the pipe that far in advance. So they can't get their books on the tables. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, this is what I mean. I still feel so new to the book industry sometimes. So I'm like, what? I had no idea that was happening.
I didn't either till like last week.
God, that is nuts.
All right. So a couple quick hodgepodge questions from listeners. And these didn't really fit in the earlier bucket, but I think would be interesting. And they go kind of quick. So how many books do you read a year?
Between probably 70 and 100. A couple years ago, I set a goal to read 100.
Yes.
And that was stupid and I'll never do it again. That's one of those Amy Poehler, good for you, not for me situations. I just did not enjoy the reading process that year. So I would say probably closer to the 80 mark, and I'm totally okay with that.
I hear you. The same thing happened to me last year.
I think it was too much stress and pressure, and then I was reading books like just to read them.
Short ones just to get a number down.
And I was like, wait, my whole life is checking things off a list. My entire life is like do lists, like getting things done. Reading, even though it is my job, has never been that for me, and I don't want it to turn into that for me. So I comfortably read probably about 80 or so books a year.
And I think y'all listeners out there, there's a lesson to be learned here. Like, there's this whole competitive reading thing over on Instagram, and how many books do you read a year? And this person reads 200, and you need to read the amount of books that feels good for your life. Okay, I got this question from multiple people, and I wasn't even going to put it in because it's not book related. But then when more than one person started asking me, I was like, okay, it's going in. What news outlets do you read / listen to / watch?
Interesting.
Isn't this funny that people want to know this about you?
Yes, but I kind of am so grateful. Like, the journalist part of me, my heart is full. This is hard. First of all, I would like to say that when I was a little girl, all I ever wanted was a subscription to a literal newspaper, like physical newspaper. The Thomasville Times Enterprise is a different kind of newspaper.
Sure, yes.
And so I do not subscribe to it, although I always tell people to support your local newspaper. And weirdly, the New York Times does not deliver here.
Oh, wow.
So I listen to The Daily, the podcast that the New York Times puts out. I really like and trust The Daily. I like Michael Barbaro, and I like the journalists he interviews. I love Pantsuit Politics and Sarah and Beth, and what they are doing, I think, is a service to this country and to people who are trying their best to, like, stay informed, but also stay nuanced and thoughtful. So The Daily and Pantsuit Politics are two podcasts I listen to. I read news stories from The New York Times and The Washington Post for a little bit of snark. Love Seth Meyers. Now, he is not an unbiased source of information. He's a comedian. Everyone should just go into that knowing that's what it is.
Yes.
But if I want just a snarky take on what's happening after I have been actually informed of what is happening, I like to watch Seth Meyers because I think he's funny. And then a Twitter voice that I really like as far as newscasters go is Jake Tapper.
Yes.
I like following on him on Twitter. I, again, think he's thoughtful and nuanced. And, you know, I think we're fooling ourselves if we think that all news journalists are totally unbiased. But I think he is trying to present the news in a nuanced way. But the voices I trust are The Daily, Pantsuit Politics. I like The New York Times. I like The Washington Post, Jake Tapper, Seth Meyers. I try really hard for my Twitter feed to be a variety of sources. So I kind of get my bases covered. Like, I try to be really thoughtful about having some thoughtful conservative voices and thoughtful liberal sources so that I can see both together. The other thing I would recommend, and I'm sure everybody's heard of it, but maybe they haven't, I do like The Daily Skim.
Yes, I read that.
I really like what those women do. They give you just a really nice overview and then links. So if you are interested in more, you can click over to the news sources, the primary sources themselves.
So there you go, y'all. Let's get moving to your recommendations. I know we're getting long on time here. Annie is going to share two old books she loves, two new books she loves, one book she does not love, and maybe one, maybe two, maybe three new releases that she's excited about. Let's start with your first old book you love.
Delancey by Molly Weisenberg. She wrote A Homemade Life, which I adore, but I think it's hard to find in print anymore. It's a food memoir, but I love Delancey. My book club just read it for the first time, and it was interesting to hear them talk about it because I read it years ago. It is about Molly and her husband. She has since divorced her husband. The book is really about, yes, their marriage, but it's also about them starting this business together. I read Delancey right when I was taking over the bookshelf, I think, like back in maybe 2013-ish. I felt so seen and understood. And I like Molly's writing. I think she's really honest. She's coming out, I think, with a book this fall because she had quite the life change. Like, her marriage dissolved, but she still runs her business with him. Delancey really hit me right when I needed it and wanted it. But then I heard my book club talking about it probably 6 months ago, and their opinions were so varied.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, this is now another one that I'm like, ooh, I want everybody to read it and tell me, because I had some people in my book club who did not like the marriage, like kind of how they communicated. And I remember loving that and thinking, these are two people where this is trying, like this is stressful. This is intense. They're going through this really kind of awful process together. And what does that look like? So we had a really interesting conversation. So we wound up talking a lot about marriage and entrepreneurship. And I just like Molly's writing style a lot. I like how she tells a story and how she tells her story so honestly. So Delancey is one of my favorite backlist titles.
I've had that book on my TBR list for years. It's going to be an audiobook for me. And now that I know she has another one coming out, it's going to move to the top.
I could be wrong, but I think her next book is a memoir as well.
That was Delancey by Molly Weisenberg. And tell us about the second old book you love.
I decided to pick a book that represents so many of the themes I love. So I love books that write about faith in a really complicated, interesting way. And Francis and Bernard is an epistolary novel that came out probably in 2012. What drew me to it was that it is a series of fictional letters written back and forth between a woman based loosely on Flannery O'Connor and one of her real life friends. And I love their platonic friendship. It was really beautiful to me. The letters were filled with interesting kind of takes on faith and life, not shying away from maybe the hard or the difficult parts about having faith. And I just loved it. If you did not like Fire Sermon and were like, why did Annie like this? Francis and Bernard is why I liked Fire Sermon.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so there's a book pairing out there for y'all too.
Yeah, even when it came out, nobody talked about it.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it.
I'm a little hesitant to share it because I'm like, man, what if it was terrible? You know, books that just hit you at the right time and then when you reread them, you're like,
Oh, yeah. Most every book I read in my childhood.
So I have not reread this. I'm not a huge rereader, but I flipped back through it and I still think it holds up, but I'm just curious why it never took off. I don't know. I loved it.
And that came out in 2013. So that was Francis and Bernard by Carlene Bauer. Okay. What is the first new book you love?
So I'm reading right now, and by the time this airs, I'm sure have finished. Fleischman Is in Trouble. Have you read this?
I have not, but I've seen it around, and I know some other people who have read it.
So I think it's making that like slow bookstagram rounds. Like I feel like I'm seeing it in the ether. This is one I picked up, like I had it as an ARC, and I just didn't read it in time for shelf subscriptions. And so when that happens, sometimes I just put off reading it because I'm like, I got to read.
For a purpose.
Yes. One of the blessings and curses of my job. Now, it's a little bit more PG-13 veering on R there at the beginning. And anybody who listens or follows along with my book taste knows I'm a little bit of a prude. So at first I was like, uh-oh, I don't know if this is going to be for me. But I am just now getting into it. And it very much reminds me of Misfortune of Marianne Palm. So it's very reminiscent of The Misfortune of Marianne Palm, where like this woman, she's embezzling money from her kid's school. That book is so snarky, dark, funny to me. That is the vibe I get from Fleischman Is in Trouble. I love the narration. I've never read anything like it. So when I started it, I couldn't figure out who the narrator was. And about, I don't know, 100 or so pages in, you realize that one of his friends is narrating on his behalf and talking about all he's been through and then kind of reaches present day. It's really, I think, very interesting and different from anything I've read recently. You know, I've said before, I love dysfunctional family literature, but not all dysfunctional family literature is the same. Like not all of it is created equal. So this one, again, feels like that dark sense of humor. It's about a man whose ex-wife, they're divorced. She leaves the kids with him and then she doesn't come back. So I am having the best time not knowing where this book is going. I am here for the ride. I think the writing is really good.
You're kind of selling me on it. I love dark humor.
This is about a middle-aged man who's all of a sudden realizing how dating works now.
Ooh, funny.
So there is some humor, but there is also, it gets a little PG-13 R because he's, you know, finding out he has some freedom and he can do things he's never gotten to do before. And at first I was a little bit like, I don't know if I need to read about a man like having some kind of sexual awakening. Like, I don't know that I need this, but I think you can really trust the author. And if you trust the author, I think the payoff is going to be worth it. I'm enjoying it so far. I'm really liking the ride she's taking me on.
And so this is interesting. It's written by a woman.
Yeah.
She's writing about this divorce from this man's perspective.
Yes. And I love it because I feel like we normally, or at least in a lot of literature I've read, we get a man writing about a woman's sexual awakening.
Right.
And I have feelings about that. And so this kind of turns that on its head. And now the narration is provided by one of his female friends, which I think has cleared things up a little bit for me narration-wise.
Oh, it's a female friend. Okay. I was imagining a male friend.
Yeah. I'm here for it. It's really different and I'm really liking it.
All right. Now this is going on my list too.
Okay. Report back.
I will. Okay, so that was Fleischman Is in Trouble by Taffy Brodesser-Eckner, and that came out June 18th. What is the second new book you love?
I know people have already heard me talk about this, but I feel like some readers are going to be hesitant, and I just want to encourage as many people as possible to push past your hesitations and read it anyway. So what I'm talking about is The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. And I have been talking about this book, I think, since January at least. I was drawn to this book because I love Colson Whitehead. Underground Railroad was one of my favorite books a couple years ago when it came out. If you haven't read it, please read it. That can be a bonus backlist book. But The Nickel Boys is loosely based on a school that was near my hometown. So I grew up in Tallahassee, Florida. There was a school called the Dozier School for Boys in nearby Marianna. Over the past probably 10 to 15 years, we have begun to realize what a horrific place the Dozier School for Boys was. Child abuse of the worst kind occurred there. And probably 10 or so years ago, journalists finally kind of brought this story to the surface. Part of the reason that happened is because a school was doing an archaeological dig and found human remains underneath the Dozier School.
Whoa, I did not know that.
Yes. And so it's this horrific secret. The Tampa Bay Times did like a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative journalism piece. They did a journalism piece, long form, about this, and it is excellent. And I remember...
I'll link to that in the show notes, y'all.
Yeah, that was a piece that broke my heart and blew my mind. The journalism is outstanding. So Colson Whitehead has written a fictional book loosely based on the Dozier School for Boys, and he calls the school the Nickel School. I can tell he's done his research because his landmarks that take place in and around Tallahassee are correct. Like, I very much know exactly what he's talking about. There is a point I reached in this book, probably 3/4 of the way through, where I think I put it down and looked up at my husband and said, Colson Whitehead is a genius. Like, there is something that happens, like the writing, where you're kind of working your way through this book, and it's horrific and it's heartbreaking, but you realize you're dealing with a genius. Like, you're dealing with this writer who has such a gift. I cannot stress that enough. I wanted to talk about it because I feel like there are going to be people who have sensitivities who don't want to read something like this, and I respect that.
Sure.
And I understand it. But I also think we have a little bit of a responsibility, if we can, to read hard things and to read things that bother us because we're supposed to be bothered. Like, we're not supposed to protect ourselves from all the things. Sometimes we're supposed to be bothered by things. And look, I say that as someone who I don't have specific sensitivities or triggers to these things. I don't have true PTSD from past experiences. I read this book and needed to be reminded about the awful things that happened right up the road from me.
Right.
So if a reader is capable, I hope that they will pick this up because I've had some experiences in the past couple of years where I just really needed my mind to be opened. There are just some things we need to know. And The Nickel Boys does a really good job. Colson Whitehead has done a good job of writing this really captivating, brilliant story. At its root, it's just a really powerful, good, well-told story, but also reminding us things like this actually happen and we need to know about them. That's my plug for The Nickel Boys. It's going to be one of my favorite books of the year.
I am on the library hold list for it. Like you, the tough stuff does not bother me. I could read A Little Life, all that.
Yeah.
I'm super excited for this one.
I can't wait to hear what you think.
So that's The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead, out July 16th. And tell us about a book you did not love.
I read on my trip to London. I wanted a book kind of set in England because I did not get to do pre-reading for this trip. Like, I think I had these grand plans of reading books about London and about England before ever leaving, but that didn't happen. So I needed an audiobook that I could listen to on the plane. And Julia Whalen is my favorite audiobook narrator. So I realized that she did the audiobook for Educated, which I really like because I'm not a huge audiobook reader in the first place. So I searched on Libro.fm for other books narrated by her and realized she had written a book called My Oxford Year. And like, I vaguely remember it coming out. So I downloaded the audiobook, listened to it. It was a perfect plain book because I really did want a book that I could kind of doze in and out of. I do fall asleep on planes, but I need a little bit of help. So what helps me is listening to something. So I slept for like 5 or 6 hours off and on the plane, thanks in part to this book, which sounds like a terrible compliment.
Yes. It's so good. It put me to sleep.
Yes. What I guess was struck by, and part of the reason this book felt a little bit flat for me, was because I would be listening to it and I would be intrigued. The first part of the book in particular, I really did like because she sets the stage so beautifully in Oxford. I felt like I was there. And when I went to Oxford, I was able to put buildings to places. Like I was able to picture it really well because of what Julia had done for me. So I thought the first couple of chapters in particular were really, really good. But what I noticed while listening was I would doze off and I would wake back up and I would feel like I'd never stopped listening. There were a lot of trips to pubs and a lot of conversations about friendship and love.
This is like watching daytime soap operas. You can tune in 2 years later and know exactly what's going on.
Okay, that is correct. So for me, I feel like, I don't want to say I'm an expert on the romantic comedy, but I am an expert on the romantic comedy.
A wonderful thing to be an expert on.
The cover very much reads rom-com. And readers had warned me that this was more like Me Before You. So I knew going in that this was going to take kind of a darker, heavier turn. That's not why I didn't like this book. We just talked about, like, you and I enjoy books with the tough stuff.
Yeah.
For me, this felt more like a Lifetime movie, which I can enjoy, but it was not what I really wanted. So I loved the parts about Oxford. I felt like she really painted a beautiful picture of that city and of that campus. But the love story was solidly in the rom part of rom-com. And I love my rom-coms to be heavy on the comedy. And so there was not a lot of comedy here. It felt like a Cinderella story, and I was not really here for it.
I hear you. That does not sound up my alley either. So that was My Oxford Year by Julia Wayland. Yes, the same Julia Wayland who narrates audiobooks. All right, let's talk about the new release or releases you're excited about.
Okay, I have three, and I want to be clear. I'm excited about these because I'm about to read them. So these are books I have not read yet.
Most people that come on have not read the books that they're sharing in this category.
Oh, good. God, I try so hard to like read ahead because that's what my job requires. The first one is Inland, and I am so sorry. I don't quite know how to pronounce her last name, and I should have looked it up before coming on here. Taya Olbrecht. The reason you might be familiar with her name is she wrote a book years ago called The Tiger's Wife.
Yes.
Did you read that?
I think I did. Does that ever happen to you?
Oh, yes. Indeed it has.
It was before my blogging days, so I don't have quite the records that I now have, but I think I did read it.
God, I loved that book. It came out years ago. I think when that novel debuted, it was her debut novel, she was like 25, and I was blown away. I could not believe a 20-something had written this book. And it had kind of this magical realism that I do not typically like at all. But for whatever reason, it really worked for me. She has a new book coming out called Inland. So this is her first book in like 12 years.
Oh, wow.
Maybe not that long, but maybe 10. It comes out this fall. It does not sound like something I would be interested in. But The Tiger's Wife didn't really sound like anything I'd be interested in either. And for some reason, I picked it up. This one is like at the top of my list of things to read just because she's already proven herself to me. So I am willing to kind of trust her and see. It's kind of another magical, mythical, almost fairy tale book.
That was Inland by Taya Olbrecht. And I don't know how to pronounce that either. By the time this episode airs, that will already be out. It will have come out August 13th. What is your next book?
Yeah, my next one is The Other's Gold. I think it's by Elizabeth Ames.
Yes.
Sign me up for dysfunctional family lit. Sign me up for campus novels.
Oh, yeah.
I'm here for them, always and forever.
I'm with you. I will grab any of those type of books immediately.
Yeah, and I don't know why that is. I think partly it's because the university I attended was not like a stereotypical, it was not maybe the picturesque college campus that I always dreamed of for myself. And so I get to live through it now vicariously through literature. So it's a campus novel that covers these friendships of four women, and it goes through different decades of their life. Like it's going to follow them past college. So I really want to like this book. I haven't read it yet. It's potential because of the timing of its publication. I'm considering it maybe possibly for a shelf subscription. I've got to read it first. But it sounds like it was made for me. Do you ever have those books where you're like, oh my gosh, somebody wrote this just for me?
Yes. And this might be one of those for me too, not surprisingly.
Gosh, I want this to be good, but I'm trying to lower my expectations.
Yes.
It's a debut. I'm trying to temper myself. I don't want my expectations to be so high that the book can't meet them. But I'm very excited about this. It is on my list to read in the next couple of weeks. I moved it from my living room to my nightstand, so I knew I was serious.
But did you hear that Jasmine Ward and Celeste Ng have blurbed it?
They did? Oh, I'm so excited.
See, I'm now doing the opposite of what you're trying to do.
Okay, but it gives me hope because you and I both know blurbs aren't everything. Like,
yeah,
we know authors are connected, blah, blah. But I'd like to think Celeste Ng and Jasmine Ward are only blurbing books they really, really like.
I hope. Although Celeste Ng does blurb a lot of books.
She does. Maybe she's just a prolific reader.
But I love her books, so I'm hopeful. Also, I read that the author is a resident faculty member at Harvard. So, like, lives on campus among the students. So, will have a very personal perspective for the book, I'm guessing.
Okay, Sarah, you're hyping me up.
I'm really not helping you here.
I'm excited. Okay.
All right. That was The Other's Gold by Elizabeth Ames, coming out August 27th. And what is your last new release you're excited about?
My last new release is Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson. I love her. Like, she's another author who has kind of proven herself to me, so I'll pretty much pick up whatever she's putting down. I really trust her. But I also read the description of this one, and it sounded to me kind of reminiscent of If Beale Street Could Talk, which I read this year and loved. And to me, she and Jasmine Ward, just because you just mentioned her, but to me, they write classic literature. Like, it feels like books that will stay around forever.
Right.
Books with staying power. And Red at the Bone sounds no different to me. Kind of takes place in 2001. And you've got these two different families. So we've got like this dysfunctional element. There's a pregnancy that brings the families together. I've been reading Ordinary People. And Ordinary People really uses music to tell the story. And my understanding of Red at the Bone is that we get to hear, because 2001, like, we get to hear the, really the soundtrack of 2001. So I think Prince plays a part. So I'm very curious how she's going to tie all this together. The description sounds part If Beale Street Could Talk, part The Mothers by Britt Bennett, which is a book that blew my mind when it came out. So Red at the Bone is right up there with The Other's Gold as far as books that I'm going to hopefully be reading in the near future.
And this is an adult novel.
Yes. Yeah. The good news about Red at the Bone for me is we all have book gurus in our lives who we trust. Hunter at Shelf by Shelf.
Yes.
He's my in real life dear friend, and he read it and he knows my personal taste.
Sure.
But he was like, no, you're going to like this. So I'm excited.
Perfect. And that is always gold for me too. That is Red at the Bone by Jacqueline Woodson, and that's coming out September 17th. All right. You ready to play Rate It?
I'm ready. Oh, I love this. I'm so ready.
So I like to end every episode with this lightning round game where I throw out five bookish things and they're tailored to you, and you rate each thing either 1 or 5 stars, just like you would rate a book, but you cannot use 2, 3, or 4 stars. It's love, hate.
Okay, love it or loathe it. Okay.
Yeah, yes. I never thought about that before, but yes.
I've got people in my staff who hate love it or loathe it because they hate binary, but I'm here.
You can elaborate briefly on your answers, by the way, if you feel you need to.
Okay.
Number one, when your shelf subscription pick ends up being a book of the month pick.
Oh, 1 star. That is the worst.
I imagine that is the bane of your existence.
On multiple levels. So it's the worst in that logistically, we have started trying to keep better track of which subscribers subscribe to both. So like then I pick a backup book.
Got it.
Because I really don't want them to get a duplicate book. They've paid for a service. I want to provide them with a book that they don't already have. But also the worst, because then it means I feel like I haven't picked something unique enough. And that makes me mad.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, 1 star all the way.
But also, too, maybe your number one book. You want to say what you're sending out every month is your number one book. And then you don't send that because Book of the Month is sending it.
Oh, this happened this summer because I think Book of the Month picked Ask Again Yes.
They did.
And that's one of my favorite of the year.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no. And the good news was, so for people who already had that book through Book of the Month, I picked City of Girls, which I also really loved. So I felt like I was sending out 2 awesome books into the world.
Yes.
But just in general, to me, there is nothing worse. We like sit in anxious pose, like waiting to find out like what Book of the Month picked.
Okay. Number 2, listening to other book podcasts.
1 star. I don't do it.
Tell us why. I know why, but I want my listeners to hear why.
Yeah, I'll tell you why. It's because, so one of my favorite podcasts is The Popcast by Knox and Jamie. I adore them. They are the real deal. They are as wonderful as you have imagined that they are. I feel like that's not true about everyone, but it is true about them. And I sometimes will box Jamie, like I want advice or I need a business person's angle or whatever. I really trust them. And one thing I know they do is they don't listen to other pop culture podcasts. And probably about 2 years ago, I realized, you know what, if I listen to book podcasts, and I was at the time, but I realized, and probably other people feel this way, right? Like when you listen to a podcast regularly, their language becomes your language.
Mm-hmm.
Even now, I really have to watch myself that I don't repeat things Knox and Jamie have said. And they are my friends, but I don't want to use their language or co-op even something like NSFAM. Like that's Jamie's code for this is not safe for Jamie's mom. And when I rate books, I want to make sure I don't steal. Like that's Jamie's. Like that is Jamie and Knox's rating system. I don't need to borrow that. So I realize that when you listen to podcasts, and for me, when I'm listening to book podcasts, I might accidentally co-op language that's not mine.
You don't even mean to. It just kind of internalizes in your head.
Yeah, it just happens. And I am a goody two shoes and I don't want to plagiarize anybody ever. I've even limited who I follow on Instagram. I love Bookstagram. I love what it has meant to my business. And I love the friendships and the people that I have interacted with there. But I have even cut back on who I follow because I don't want my brain to accidentally be infiltrated.
Yeah, it makes sense. All right. Number three, deciding which ARCs to read.
5 stars. That's fun.
Yeah, I kind of agree, but also overwhelming.
It's overwhelming, but I have gotten way better. You know, I think early on, I used to feel like, gosh, I've got to read every book they send me. First of all, we get more than we used to. I have gotten way better at realizing, no, I do not have to read everything that somebody sends me.
Right.
I get to pick and choose, read with a purpose. You know, I'm reading for shelf subscriptions, reading to sell, and then still reading for fun. So I think I've really tried hard in the past few years to strike a better balance. And as a result, it is not the chore that for a while it was.
Right. How do you decide? Do you have a system?
I don't have a system. It's very serendipitous. I do have like a stack in my living room, but it's kind of sort of arranged by date it comes out. And if it is too long ago, I give it away.
Yeah.
You just can't hold on to them forever.
No.
Jordan sometimes will help me pick. I'll be like, oh, I just read literary fiction. And so I'll know it's time for a thriller. Or I just read this 500-page tome. So I'm going to read like a YA novel. So I do kind of mix it up in that way.
So you mood read a little bit.
Oh, for sure. In fact, I mood read probably a lot. I mean, I do read with purpose. So I definitely read because my job requires that. Shelf subscriptions is the biggest one probably. But otherwise, I'm very much reading for what am I in the mood for right now?
Right. I think that helps your reading life too. I know it helps mine. Helps it stay fresh.
Yeah. And you get in slumps. So like right now I mentioned I'm reading Ordinary People, which I like. And I like it a lot, but I'm so over it. Like, I'm so ready to be done. It's not the book's fault. It's my fault. I've moved on.
Right.
So I think you are more inclined to be put in reading slumps when you're not reading by your mood.
I totally agree. All right. Number four, listening to audiobooks with your spouse.
5 stars. Love it.
I love that you all do this. I'm jealous. My husband's not a reader. So I put something on. He's like, oh, really?
Oh, no. We love it. We're big podcast listeners. So we listen to a lot of podcasts. But when we road trip together, we do try to either have a podcast series, like a true crime series.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to tell another fun thing that people will probably roll their eyes at, but we do also occasionally read aloud together.
Oh, that's so cute.
Jordan had never read From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Baisley Frankweiler, so we alternated reading aloud to each other. I typically wind up reading aloud more because I'm a visual learner and he's an audio learner, so I process better if I'm reading it. Yeah, so we occasionally, not often, but like occasionally we'll pick a kid's book or a book. We did Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil that way a few years ago, so we'll pick one that we read aloud, and I think that's why audiobooks work for us. This is something that I think we would do more of if we were together more, but when are we together is in the car on a road trip.
Absolutely. And you don't have screaming kids at the back, so.
That's right. We're healthy right now, so this obviously is also easier for us to do than for other people.
Yes. I have to stick to podcasts if my kids are in the car because I miss too much with audiobooks if they're in the car. All right. Number five, and I'm asking you this question for a reason. Jane Austen, and because I know you sometimes struggle with classics, as do I, and you also just visited her childhood hometown.
5 stars.
Awesome.
5 stars. I could weep. In fact, I'll try to hold it in. I think she's a genius. I already thought that before we went, but we got to go to her birthplace and seeing the humility with which she lived her life. And yet she was also extremely snarky and witty and was not afraid of being those things.
In a time when women probably weren't supposed to be those things.
Yes. And she was a person of faith. I'm a person of faith. I value my faith and take it very seriously. But I also, you know, there's doubt, there's struggle, there's angst, there's snark, there's humor. I value so much people who can wrestle with all of those things. And weirdly, Jane Austen is one of those.
Right.
The other reason I love her is because her works have stood the test of time in that they can be interpreted in a variety of different ways and performed a variety of different ways, and they still hold true. I frequently will talk about the YouTube series, The Lizzie Bennet Diaries.
Right.
They're amazing. Without Jane Austen, this wouldn't have been possible, and I don't think they would have been as good.
Sure.
I could talk about it forever. I think it's so meaningful. How somebody with such depth and humility and humor, how her work still exists, is just this legacy I can't fully gush about enough.
So this is going to literally break your heart, but I've never read Jane Austen.
I just went on for like 5 minutes.
Jane Austen is my mother's Lord and Savior. She's been trying to get me to read Jane Austen for so very long, and I'm so scared of the classics. Not scared of them, but I just have trouble with them. And so I just haven't done it. And Mom, if you're listening, look, I've got Annie on here, and look, listen to how she talks about Jane Austen.
Look, can I give you a piece of advice that was given to us on our trip?
Yes.
So Erin Moon, who you know through the podcast.
Yes.
And she just did an Instagram story series about this you might have seen. But she was not a Jane Austen fan at all. I think her line was like, miscommunication is not a plot device. And so when we went on our tour, Phil asked, like, who doesn't like Jane Austen? And so Erin raised her hand, and he was like, I'm going to try to change your mind. He was like, I was not a Jane Austen fan either. You've got to start with her letters.
Oh, okay.
Because then you get a sense of who she is. Because I'm going to be honest, I read Pride and Prejudice. I tried to read it in high school because, of course, Kathleen Kelly read it and loved it. So I was going to read it and love it. I couldn't finish it, couldn't get through it. Approached it my freshman year of college and loved it. Thought it was brilliant. Read Emma, thought it was fine. I don't even know that I have a relationship to her work the way other people do, but learning about her and knowing who she was and of her time. Anyway, I think you maybe might want to listen to Phil's advice and maybe read some of her letters first.
I'll start there. Annie, this has been so wonderful.
Thank you so much. I hope I didn't talk too much. I feel like when it comes to books, like, I am such an introvert, but when it comes to books, I could go on forever.
No, don't be sorry. I'm the same as you. And I feel like this conversation could continue for a couple more hours. But y'all listeners, I just want you to know this. I'm going to edit this episode, but the actual record time was 1 hour and 45 minutes.
We could have watched a movie.
Wow. And this episode is longer than what you're used to, but Annie said so many amazing things that I think it deserves to be. So
thank you, Sarah. Thank you for this opportunity. I just so appreciate even being asked. It's really an honor.
Thank you for being here. And I know all the listeners will be very excited to hear you. And everybody, we are now back to our weekly airing schedule now that school is back in session and my kids are not at home as much. And as I've mentioned before, I'm trying a slightly different schedule. I'll have full-length episodes every other week, and on the off weeks, I will have shorter episodes that are 20 minutes or less featuring regular readers and book bloggers and bookstagrammers just doing the recommendation portion of the show. So that means no discussion portion and no rate it game afterwards. So I'll be back next week with the first mini episode. Talk to you next week.
Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions, especially since we're just starting out. Find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at sarahsshelves, on Instagram at sarahsbookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. Happy reading!